Welcome back, Rhetoric Warriors podcast, a broadcast of the Ethical Persuasion Institute, which doesn't exist yet, but will if things work out. Complicated times require sophisticated techniques, so we're trying to turn up people's understanding and ability to interpret and create messages here in our complicated times. Politics got broken, so I was like, you know what? I think I should resurrect my rhetoric PhD and see if I can do some good things with it. I'm Dr. Dan, American rhetorician, late night comedy writer and stand-up, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. The purpose of the show is to talk to comedians about their politics because they have different views about things. And I uncensor them. I will let them say whatever they want. And I also convert conservatives on here because I think they've jumped off the Democratic rails and actually have techniques to go back and pull them out of their mesmerization. And I talk persuasion pros, social issue people, messaging pros of all kinds, and straight up rhetoricians. My guest today, very fascinating to me, this area of our messaging world. She's a messaging pro, super experienced in journalism, nonfiction, and especially ghostwriting. Over 20 books that she's ghostwritten, including books for the First Lady Jill Biden, Senator Tammy Duckworth, and many of the Hollywood elite. So we're going to talk to her about all this process. Lisa Dickey.
Howdy. Happy to be here.
Good solid Southern greeting from a Florida person. Howdy.
Oh, yeah. Listen, I hear that Southern accent you have. My whole family's from the South. So, you know, I'm hearing over there.
Yeah, there's a little bit of Kentucky still left in me.
Yep.
I escaped when I was 17, went to college, but it never really goes away.
It never goes away. It's true.
Well, why don't you introduce yourself a little bit for us? Just give us a quick orientation. I read through your bio and I've sort of seen what you do, but let everybody know kind of what your background is.
Yeah, so I've been helping people write books since about 1997. And that involves, sometimes it's ghostwriting, sometimes it's something we call book doctoring, which is they do a bunch of the writing and then I help them fix it, make it better. It's all nonfiction. A lot of it is memoirs, which is my favorite thing to do. I love storytelling. It's basically like, feels like you're writing a novel, but it's a true story. And previous to that, I was a journalist for a couple of years. I lived in St. Petersburg, Russia. I had studied Russian in college and I decided to live there and try to write some stories and see if I could sell them and make a career. Good fun, did that for a while. And worked at WashingtonPost.com for a little while as well, where I met a mutual friend of ours, you and me, our friend Tammy Kennan. And I just have always been interested in writing, and it took me a while to figure out how to get there. I didn't start until I was in my late 20s, but I feel like I've made up for lost time since then.
It's definitely a corral of people in the world, right, who are still attached to the written format. Like, just,
yeah,
it works in your brain. It works for what you want to do every day. Mm-hmm. They're still out there.
Words, words, words. Yeah.
Even though, the digital, I ran into this a lot when I was a professor teaching. I taught screenwriting and TV writing and speech writing and, you know, even journalism for a little bit. And just, it's so unfamiliar to so much of the young population now, just the hardcore-ness of reading and writing. But I think when I was growing up, mm-hmm. we talked about, like, I got out of Kentucky essentially through books, right? Kentucky wasn't that interesting. So I just read everything that was interesting, written by interesting people. And it just becomes a part of the way you see the world.
Yeah, it's very true. It's very true. And I can remember my dad saying to me, you know, I said, oh, I'm going to move to Russia and become a writer. And he said, listen, I'm glad you enjoy writing, but you can't make a living doing it. Cause he was a Navy guy. He was a Navy officer and he was terrified I was going to end up like broke and, you know, coming to them for money and whatever. And yeah, it's just like, I think people can make a living doing it. I don't think it's easy, but I'm really going to try. So yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I think there'll always be that niche, right? Of like, it's always there. I mean, writing isn't going away, even if it's not the favorite format right now. So you need people that can do it.
It's really, yeah, it's, I mean, as popular as a lot of these other media have become, I, you know, book sales are still really strong and people are still buying books and reading books, you know, and I don't think, I hope that that's never going to go away. You know, I think long form is something that people have to, you know, focus on doing. I think everybody gets a little Twitterified, you know, and then be these little quick hits, you know, but, you know, books do seem to be, they just keep on going strong, which is great. It's really nice to see.
So are you decidedly like a long form person? Do you also do short form? Because I've always, we'll talk about all this, but I've done a bunch of ghostwriting, but it's all been mostly in stand up, which is a five minute bit, six minute, you know, you listen to somebody's life or their idea and you go away and you write it with them or whatever, but it's quick hitter. Like my brain likes turn and burn.
Yep. I mean, there's like all kinds of ghostwriting, right? Like people don't think about that in terms of when they hear the word ghostwriting, I think they automatically go to books, but yeah, what you do is definitely ghostwriting. People ghostwrite for executives at companies all the time. They write speeches, they write, you know, social media posts, they do all kinds of things, you know, and all of that, anything I think where you're channeling somebody or you're the vessel for their thoughts to get on the page or to get on the screen or whatever it is, you know, all of that is a form of ghostwriting. But yeah, my brain just really prefers long form. I did, when I was working as a journalist, I was never really interested in, you know, like 300 or 500 or 800 word stories, news stories where you would just chase down the facts and then you would write, you know, the inverted pyramid, you know, whatever, of like, here's all the information that you get down to your point. And I just never was really interested in that. It just felt like a lot of work to me for a story that was going to be fish wrapped the next day, you know? And with books, I felt like, you know, you can do a book, like these books I've done with people like Jill Biden or Tammy Duckworth or Patrick Swayze or Herbie Hancock or whatever, like that is the definitive book that they put out about themselves and will be forever. Like if somebody's at, you know, still thinking about Patrick Swayze in 100 years, they're probably going to read that book. And that to me is super cool. I just think that's really cool to be putting something out into the world that will maintain its value and will exist in perpetuity as long as there are books, you know?
Yeah, it is. It is a form of that longevity of things. And when you work in TV and you work in stand-up can have longevity. Like I've literally got jokes in my show and jokes that I've written for other people that I've done for 30 or 35 years, you know, they live on if it's an evergreen joke, but most of it's churning. It is that churn and burn. Like when you write for late night TV every day, you come in, you write the jokes.
Yeah.
I used to tell people about this, that, you know, you have 5 or 6 people on staff. You may write 300 jokes, 20 get used in the show.
Right. Yeah.
The other 280 are just radioactive runoff in Hollywood. They just disappear into the ether.
Yep. You work and work and work, and then there it goes. But, you know, I got to be honest, too, though. The other thing that I really was into about books was, you know, when I was writing, like, it was basically feature articles. I did a lot of stuff for the Moscow Times. I wrote some stuff for USA Today. But it was always like, here, I'm going to pitch this idea to this editor, and maybe the editor takes a day or two to think about it. And then they're like, well, actually, why don't you do it this way? Okay, all right. So how many words are we going to do? Well, how much are you going to get paid? Okay. So I go out and I write the story or whatever. And then I got to invoice them. And then, you know, maybe they pay me right away. Maybe they don't pay me for 6 weeks. And it was just this, it just felt like I was on a treadmill all the time, you know? Whereas if you do a book, you know, you're employed for whatever the period of time is that you're doing the book. And that can be, I mean, in my case, the shortest one was like 5 weeks and the longest one was 2 years. And so it's like, okay, I'm going to do this. Here's what I'm going to make. And I don't have to run around chasing stuff down. And I can really sink my teeth into something and really learn. Like, I mean, doing a book with Herbie Hancock's like, you know, it's like I got a master's degree in jazz, just spending hours upon hours upon hours talking to him. He's absolutely the master, you know? So it's like, oh, here I am learning about jazz from Herbie Hancock. Mm-hmm. People would pay a lot of money for that, right? But instead I got paid to listen to him talk about jazz and then me, you know, get it on the page with him, you know? So that part of it is super, super cool.
Yeah, for people, I think, because I intellectualize everything, I'm half creative, half intellectual. And no matter what I do, I always step back from it and say, what did I just do and how did I do it? And then I tend to write it up. in some way. And I've done a lot of business communication over the last 5 to 7 years. I have a digital marketing agency in Austin with a partner. And I do the creative side and I do the persuasion strategy. And one of the things I noticed is that businesses never meta about their messaging process. Like Hollywood locks messaging down. You know, like there's a pipeline structure where 100 people can work on the same message, the show, all at once and keep it moving. Mm-hmm. But business doesn't work like that. They tend to scrum and scramble and brainstorm and not really have a process. And it always drove me crazy. And so I'm like, where are the flaws? Like, and the first is information. They don't turn their chaos mm-hmm. into actual ordered information. And, you know, as a writer,
right.
that once you get down to actually writing the message, if the information isn't clean, you can't work.
Yeah.
And so it's information and then some kind of strategy about what kind of message they want. They have to set that beacon and then you can mm-hmm. be functional as a message creator.
Yep. That's very true. And it sort of points to one of the elements, I think, of what I do and what you do as well, right? Like you, if you are going to write jokes for somebody, or if I am going to write a book for somebody, you know, in order to truly understand something in order to like well enough to get it on the page, you have to really understand it, right? Like somebody can tell you something or explain something to you, but it's not till you turn around and try to explain it back to them that you start to understand where the holes are and where it is that you don't understand, right? So you have to get it in your head to such a degree, you just have to be supremely organized to do this kind of work, right? Like what we do, like you have to really be like so structured and so organized and figure out here's the material and here's how this thing connects with that thing in order to do it well, you know? And I think it's interesting because it's people think about like writers who make a living writing as basically, well, if you can write, you can do it. And it's like, not really. Like there's just this whole other thing. And when you're ghostwriting for people, there's a significant component of like therapizing them, honestly, right. Like this psychological connection that you need to have and establish and the level of trust that you need to have. And, you know, it takes a tremendous amount of trust on the part of somebody to hire somebody like me and say, why don't you go out there and like be my voice? You know, that's really hard. And I'm sure for you too, it's these stand-up comics who are, everything they do is very personal. You know, it's got to sound like them. It's got to feel like, you know, natural for them. And for them to hire somebody like you, I mean, it speaks really well of your skills for them to be like, I trust you to go out and not only write a funny joke, but write a funny joke in the way I would write a funny joke. You know, it's a totally different thing. There's like multiple layers to it.
Yeah, the relationship component between you and the source of, you know, this information, these ideas and perspectives and experiences is really fascinating because they have to trust you. They have to tell you honestly. They can't be trying to impress you with their information because you don't want exaggerated information. You have to at least start with the baseline truth. You can flavor it however you want, but if they can't give you that, then if you don't have clean information, you can't move forward.
And it is, I mean, that relationship has to go both ways, right? So like as doing a person doing what I'm doing, like I'll get calls about potentially, you know, collaborating with somebody really famous or really like, you know, super accomplished or super intimidating or whatever. And I never approach it like, oh, I'm going to go and have this interview and I need to impress them or I need to persuade them to hire me. Because it's like dating, right? Like if you have to persuade somebody to date you, it's not going to work. Like either you two have to be like, oh, I'm kind of into this person, you know? And if you are, if it's like, if there's a mutual, you know, like desire to work together, then it will work. But if one person or the other person is kind of like trying to impress or persuade the other one, forget it. It's just going to end badly for everybody.
So there needs to be like Tinder or Bumble for
ghostwriters.
Yeah.
That's right. Match them up. Ooh, I like this one. Swipe.
Right. No. Maybe. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. And like when you said, people don't really realize how common this is. I mean, if you look back in the history of literature, like Cyrano, you know, is the most famous ghostwriter, right? But when you look at it and you're like, almost no text, I think, when you really look at it theoretically, is ever singularly written. Like people are always pulling influences. There was an article in the a Twitter storm yesterday about Beyonce having 24 credited writers on one of her songs.
That's right.
And one of the traditional songwriters, I can't remember her name, Diane Warren.
Diane Warren.
Was saying, how can
Diane Warren was all like, what's that about? How can 24 people write a song? And I'm like, oh, honey, you just stepped right in it, didn't you?
But you understand it like from a position of the pure communicator who is just expressing their soul. And it's, you know, this concept of communication that it's that is mono, which is an illusion. Versus, yeah, if you really credited everybody on every song that said something that you grabbed and used or influenced it, it'd probably all be 25 writers. Yeah.
You know, it's funny, like thinking about, so one thing I would say is like, sorry to everybody out there who thinks all the actors and all the politicians and all those people actually write their own books, because the vast majority of them do not. The vast majority of them hire somebody like me to help them. Either because they can't do it, they don't want to do it, they don't have time to do it. Why would they bother if they can hire somebody like me? So that's just, I mean, there are some exceptions, but it's pretty rare. But also there's editors who are working on these books as well. Mm-hmm. You know, these editors are working very hard, and agents sometimes get involved. And of course, you know, people sometimes have their, you know, they'll read it aloud to their spouse or to whomever, and then that person has input, you know. It's pretty rare. It's funny, as you were saying that, I was like picturing, I don't know if you watched Dickinson, the Emily Dickinson series that came out. I forget what it was on. It was Hulu, I think. Or was it Apple? I don't know. I can't remember. I never can remember which of the streaming services. But anyway, it's this great, it's all about Emily Dickinson. And she literally would just sit up in her room and write all this stuff and then stuff it into a desk because she didn't want to show it to anybody. Right. You know? So that's like, it's just a totally different kind of thing though. You know, and I think that's pretty rare these days for somebody to just be like writing and writing and writing and not even getting any kind of feedback from anybody. So.
Well, and even within that, like I'm in joke writing, I'm a counterpuncher. Like I write best in dialogue. So if somebody says something to me, my brain comes up with seven options really quick and then plucks one and says it back. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways, you know, they're playing straight man. But they're co-authoring it because without them, I couldn't get to that joke. And you see this a lot in writers' rooms. Like you have people that are funny in the room, and then you have people who are funny getting stuff on the show into the script. Yeah. And they're not always the same people.
But the other thing too is that it's like, you know, the creative process. Like I love reading books about that interview writers on their process because everybody's different. Some people are like, you have to be like, get up at 7 a.m, have your coffee, take your walk, sit down at 8, like everything has to be. And then other people are like, you know, sometimes you feel it and then you do it. And then sometimes you don't. And sometimes you have to go to a different place. And sometimes people are like, you got to sit in the same place every time. And everybody's different because everybody's creative process is different. Right. So it may be that on Beyonce's new album, which by the way, is absolutely magnificent. If you haven't listened to it yet, it is just mind-blowingly great. But like, maybe the best way to get those songs or pull those songs together was to have 24 people who are involved in whatever capacity. Now, some of those are, as Diane Warren learned, you know, yesterday when she tweeted that and immediately got piled on, some of that is samples, you know, some of that is music that has been made in the past and is being, you know, used also on a new song. I think the more important point is like, why does Diane Warren care if 24 credited songwriters are on a song? Like, do you like the song or you don't like the song? Like, who cares? Everybody has a different process. Everybody can create however they want to create. And collaboration is an amazing thing. Like, if you're able to collaborate with someone and have that kind of relationship that's going to elevate your art, that's pretty amazing. Or if you're Diane Warren and you write songs by like taking a walk on the beach with your dog and all of a sudden a full melody pops into your head, then that's great too. Like it's just, you know, however you create the thing, that's how you create the thing, you know?
It is interesting though, all the issues that start to spring up within this, like the idea of the exalted genius author, right? And that's kind of what Diane Warren is clearly reacting against. She's like, these things just occur in my beautiful head. Versus you're packing this together from all these things, and that's probably a lesser type of communication. Like that's a lesser messaging. It's kind of what she got piled on for, right?
It was funny how she did it because she kept she kept acting like, I'm not judging. It's like, she was clearly judging. Like, she was obviously judging, but she didn't want people to do what they did, which is to pile on her because she was judging, you know? But I don't know. It doesn't, like, I just kind of feel like there are as many ways and methods of creating as there are human beings on earth, you know? And it's like, well, far be it for me to say this is lesser or not as good or not as whatever. I don't know. I mean, I don't really, I'm not as concerned with, well, how did you put this together, as I am, well, how does it make me feel when I listen to it, you know?
Yeah, and that's totally, clearly, like I said, there's so many places with, this is why I love rhetoric, because rhetoric will take all this apart and you know, section it into where it's breaking and where it's not. And if you're judging it based on the outcome of the message, like, do we end up with a piece of art here? Something interesting, something valuable. It doesn't matter how we get there.
Right.
Versus, do you look at the process and say, hey, here's 100 different processes. If we were to rank order them as far as the ones we think are, you know, better or purer or more natural, like rhetoric gets railed mm-hmm. at a lot of times because it's seen as manipulation to be very sophisticated in your messaging techniques. And if you use unethical mm-hmm. techniques, sure. But you also do the same thing. You're very sophisticated with ethical techniques, but you're still manipulating mm-hmm. the message. You're not naturally expressing. And so, mm-hmm. you know, it just depends on where you end up locating your point of judgment.
Right. Yeah.
Like, I would think that even within ghostwriting, there's something of a hierarchy of, like, you're a high quality ghostwriter. I mean, you've got to be one of the top ghostwriters in the world.
Yeah, I think I'm up there. Yeah. Yeah.
Ooh, ooh. Ooh, ooh, ooh.
Look at me. Look at me.
And that ethos, that credibility is important to you. It gets you paid yeah. more. Gets you in demand yeah. more. You know, so
yeah.
you see why, like, some of that communicator art, that communicator skill level, you know, becomes yeah. important to people.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it is. I mean, it's such a weird thing. It's such a weird way to make a living, you know? Like, it's such a, there's parts of me that's like, oh, I wish I could, like, just write all my own books, you know? But then there's part of me that thinks, you know, look at the, like, level of readership that these things get, you know? Like, there's just hundreds of thousands of books sold that I had a hand in, and that's super exciting, you know? And I did write my own book that came out in 2017, and it sold absolutely at least tens of copies. So, you know, it was like, I'm so proud of it and I'm so glad I did it. But at the same time, it's like, you know, okay, back to, you know, working with these people who have like a natural constituency of book buyers and honing their message and putting things out into the world, which, by the way, like, this is a thing for me where it has always felt really important throughout my whole career. Anytime somebody gets in touch with me about, you know, I want to do a book and are you interested in collaborating with me? I always need to have a conversation with them where I really dig into, why are you doing this book? Like, what is the point? What are you trying to put out into the world? And occasionally it's somebody who just is like, I just want to tell this story. This is an interesting story or whatever. But unless there's a larger point behind it that I think actually adds something to the sort of, you know, global discussion, I'm not really interested, you know? Like, everybody does have an interesting story. Everybody in the world has had interesting things happen to them. Like, there's just life is weird and grand and strange. And like, everybody's had stuff happen to them. But my question is always to the people, like, what is the message you're trying to convey? And why is it that you are the person that should be conveying this message, you know? Or is there a slice of history here that nobody has ever told? You know, I did a book with a guy about the wireless industry, which sounds like the most boring thing in the world, but the wireless industry, cell phones, the way it came about,
changed the whole world.
It was completely an absurd thing where they basically gave away all of the like air real estate on which the cell phone signals would be. It would be like giving away the Grand Canyon or giving away all the national parks for free. They literally handed it to people. And so people started taking advantage of it, and they started doing these late night infomercials and being like, everybody apply and everybody will get a tiny little slice and you're all gonna get rich, I promise. And guess what? They did, and it was insane. And then people would end up like, oh, look, I now own the cell phone, you know, rights to Yuma, Arizona. What am I going to do with it? Oh, I'm going to turn around and sell it to this guy, Craig McCaw, who actually knows how to build a cell phone industry. So instead of the United States government getting all the money, instead, they handed it to all these schmoes who called this late night infomercial where Merv Griffin was telling them to like send money in. And all those people got money. And then Craig McCaw built the thing anyway. All of which is to say, when I first took this interview with this dude who wanted to write this book, I was like, there is a 0% chance I'm going to want to help a guy write a book about the cell phone industry. Then he started telling me some of these stories. And I thought, this is a history that needs to be on the page. This is always and forever will be the definitive history of how that industry got started, which I think is just really cool.
There, like you said, there's so many sub-stories inside the sort of major cover story, you know, the scan story that we all like, oh, I understand that now. No, no, you don't. Like there's so much subterranean humanness going on underneath everything. It's really fascinating. And again, the ghostwriter, I think, I had a lunch with or coffee the other day with a buddy of mine who's I wrote with on a couple of shows, and he writes on Bill Maher now. But he gets pulled in to do joke writing for A-list actors and Hollywooders for different events or whatever. And Brad Pitt, they knew he was going to win the supporting actor, best supporting actor award, you know, for that, for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And so he wanted jokes. And so for 6 weeks, my buddy Bob wrote jokes with Brad Pitt, talking to him every day on the phone or texting him, a bunch of joke options. And I remember watching when Brad Pitt received, which award it was, but he did the joke of, well, I'm going to have to add this to my Tinder profile. And as soon as I heard it, I knew a professional joke guy.
That was your guy, yeah.
It was too sharp, but that was Bob.
That's really funny.
You know, and so there's all that stuff floating around in the world that you don't know authorship. Yeah. All you know is the, you know, end.
That's true. You know. Yeah. Speaking of which, here's a great example of that, right? So we all watch the Oscars, right? And then Chris Rock tells the joke about, you know, about Jada and her bald head, you know, and then this leads to the slap and it's all anybody can talk about. And all I could think was, did Chris Rock actually write that joke? Or did somebody else write that joke for Chris Rock and they're about to never work in Hollywood again? Like, I was really curious. And I'm pretty sure Chris Rock just like said that on the stage. I don't think that was written for him.
Well, my buddy Chuck is Chris Rock's joke writer, and he was there that night. So if you wanted the definitive history of the slap, Chuck knows it. He doesn't
did
like
Chuck write that joke.
He did not. Like he, from what I understand, it was just an off the cuff from Chris.
I heard that Chris was winging it. That's what I heard from my sources, who I'm not going to name, but it's not your friend Chuck, but it's somebody else.
Yeah, and it was definitely a wing it joke. It was a stand up club joke because it was an old reference. It wasn't a particularly good joke. Like it was way, you know, out of date.
It really wasn't. Yeah.
But, you know, it was just a little zinger, which you do all the time in clubs, and he's a club comic. So
it's hardly the meanest thing that was ever said on the Oscar stage to people sitting in the audience, but, you know, I can understand them being unhappy about it. But yeah, the slap was a whole other level. The slap heard around the world.
There's the other thing, right? Shouldn't he have been slapping the writer? Like, or should he slap the mouth that said it?
But I think it was one and the same, don't you?
Yeah, no, I'm just saying, like, you never know. Like, I'm really good at writing, like, hardcore, raw zingers about Hollywood. Like, I've worked on shows that are snarky.
Wait, but hold up. Wait, let's roll back to what you just said, though, right? So what does that mean? Like, if I ghostwrite a book for somebody and they sign off on everything I've done, and then somebody gets pissed off for what's in the book, who is responsible, me or the author?
Well, I think, again, if we go back to it theoretically and we start divvying up responsibility, like, do you escape all responsibility? It's still your words and you sold it back to the author. You know, you probably did some type of persuasion to get it in there.
It's an interesting question though, right? Like, who's ultimately responsible, particularly if my name's not in the book?
Well, there's blame and then there's actual responsibility, right?
Right. Yeah.
So
yeah.
ultimately, and this is also odd because I do a ton of foundational symbol work for businesses, and which means their names, their slogans, the company persona, all the things that are going to stand for them out in the world. And those are really important decisions for a company because it determines mm-hmm. lots of things for years. And I don't want to be in the, what if I come up with the wrong stuff and I ruin the company?
Yeah, yeah.
Am I liable?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. You know, I used to tell people, I used to joke in the beginning when I first started doing this, and somebody would read one of the books that I had worked on, and I would say, whatever you love, that's what I did. Whatever you hate, that's what the author did.
I like it. That's probably more true.
Because, you know, you can't ever say exactly what you did anyway. So I just might as well, like, be like, all of my stuff is the brilliant stuff.
Well, ultimately, it goes back to who is the decider. It goes back to the strategy. Like, who actually makes the decision about what version or what is going to go into that book, how it's going to be said? Is it the client, or is it you guys collaborating together, or is it the editor? Like, you know,
it's not me. I mean, it's not, it's their book. You know what I mean? Like, it really is. Like, that really is. And it's funny, you know, I mean, in my experience, people are very, very involved. I remember hearing Larry King. I remember hearing about him that he was like, so shocked to find what was in his books, or he just didn't even know. He got interviewed about one. He's like, oh, I'm not even sure. I haven't even read it yet. Like, you know, he just didn't even know and didn't even really seem to care. But, you know, all of my people that I've worked with have been extremely involved in everything.
But are they competent deciders?
I mean, are they competent deciders? I don't even know what that means. You know what I mean? Like, you've got to, it's your book, you know, it's your book.
I know. But, and so
there's a difference between like, me writing a book about someone, and it's like a biography of, and I'm helping someone write their autobiography. It's just two different things. Like, ultimately, I think the responsibility does lie with them.
Yeah. I mean, they're legitimate deciders. They've got the right to decide, usually. But are they the most competent communication entity to be making that decision?
Maybe not. Maybe not. Not everybody is super competent at communications.
They're never the right ones. They're never the right ones. They're not. Yeah. Like, I've worked with a lot of comics that go through a range of talent that they bring to the moment. Like, I wrote for Dennis Miller, and he had lost his mind by the time I wrote for him. But he was still unerringly correct on his comedy radar. When you put a set of jokes in front of him, he picked the top 5 to 7 jokes every time. You know, and so he was a very competent decider for jokes. Now, information and truth, he was terrible at.
Yeah. Interesting.
Do you shape people? Do you feel like you steer them? Like, what are your, I'm sure you do.
Sure, yeah. I'll make suggestions, and I'll sometimes very strongly suggest going in one direction or another direction. You know, but ultimately people can choose, you know, they make decisions. Most of the time, I think they make the right decision. And sometimes they make a decision I think is a poor decision. The worst one for me was early in my career. I was working with somebody who decided they were tired of being fixed, having their text fixed by me. And so instead of sending, you know, we went back and forth with all these edits and fixes and changes, and I was really improving the book. But they just decided they weren't interested. And so they just sent their original writing to the editor and was like, here's the manuscript. Editor then sends it out to the copy editor. The copy editor sends it back. They send me a version of the copy edit. And I start reading it and I'm like, oh my God, like, they copy edited the wrong book. Like, they copy edited the first draft, not like the third draft, which is what, you know, we've been working on all these months. You know, and get in touch with them. And they're like, no, this is what the author sent. And I was like, oh boy, like, they just were like, they paid me, but they didn't use my stuff, right? New York Times reviewed the book and basically said, this is an okay book, but it would have been really so much better if they had hired a professional writer to help them. And I was like, so what do? Like, you can't go out, and I'm not going to tell you who it is, because you can't go out and then be like, I worked on this book, but the person like totally didn't listen to me. And some books are like that, where it's like, you know, you get a reviewer will review it and be like, this decision was terrible. And you think, I wish they had listened, you know. But there's nothing you can do about it. It's not your, like, that's what I'm saying. Like, ultimately, the book is the author's book. I cannot make the author make a certain decision. And I have to, like, if I want to put the book on my resume or on my website, I have to just live with whatever decisions they may have made that I think are not great decisions for the book.
Yeah, it's a tough space to, as a professional, ultimately, as long as you're not doing something totally heinous and you get paid, you're like, okay, next.
Yeah.
You know, but there is a sense on the other side of, hey, this is going to, if I'm associated with this, it's got to have a certain level of quality or it denigrates your credibility.
It doesn't feel good, you know, it doesn't feel good. It's just, you're just like, oh, you know, it just feels embarrassing or it just feels like, oi, and then you can't really, you know, tell people. And then you're just like, ugh, all right, on to the next, you know, because like you say, I mean, it is. I think like every book I have done, I always just pour myself into it. Like it's like my magnum opus, you know, like this is the most important book I'll ever write. And I think some people are just like, it's a job, you know, I'm going to do the best I can. I'm not going to worry about it. But I'm always like, if we just do, you know, I'm just always like, just a little more here and a little, but really, really like, do you really want to do that? Because I really think, you know, and just getting super, super extra involved, you know, and taking it personally if somebody makes a decision the other way and just feeling like, just listen to me. You know, it's funny. It's really hard. It's really hard.
Well, I think you're instilling that good space of non-cynical professional. Like if you get beat up enough by it where you're just like, it's a job, I'll do it to the level that they're happy with it and I don't care.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people who end up there, you know, in professional communication across the board, doesn't matter what industry of it you're in. But for me, like in the same way, like I'm probably even more extreme than you. I've written for so many comics and so much of it that I basically have a domination agreement with them now, like do it the way I write it or I'm not going to write it.
Yeah, or screw you, I quit.
You know, they're not paying me much anyway. Like when I wrote for big comics and stuff, sure, I would just write tons of jokes, they throw most of them away, grab the ones they like, go. But if I'm writing for, like, I've got a guy I've written for years just for fun. He at first paid me and then he ran out of money, but I just find him amusing. And so I wrote a 10-minute bit for him the other day.
Yeah.
About how, like, he's very, you know, he's got this long beard now. He looks homeless, lives in Florida, and just how he can have fun by just going to nice places. Like, if he just goes to shop, like at a nice department store, how it just becomes a whole, you know, fun day.
Wait, hold up. So you're writing for him for free just because you're amused by him?
Yeah.
Wow. That's
but he's got to do it as I write it, because every time he changes it.
Well, I mean, obviously he's not paying. Well, obviously he has to do it as you write it. That's crazy.
Comics don't listen to anything, but he does because he can't write jokes. You know?
I think it's really interesting too, though. Like, I think like once you've been doing it for a while, I think in the beginning you're always sort of like, or I was anyway, like, well, maybe we could. And like, I don't want to step on your toes, but blah, blah, blah. And now it's like, all right, I've done this a long time. I need you to trust me. Here's what I'm going to tell you, you know? And then just being like, oh, I just always assume like, well, they probably know how they want to do their book better. But now I'm like, no, let me tell you how this should go. This is what makes the most sense. Are you comfortable with it? You're not? Why? Okay. Let's like figure out if there's a way to do it. But it's just, you just gain confidence, I think, after doing it for so many years. So many years. So many years upon years upon years.
Well, you do. You start to percolate up, right? And your super expertise in this particular, you know, form of writing. And so you do. You see.
Like I ended up, you know, I was always the youngest person in the room and every client of mine was older than me. And then now I've started to have clients who are my age or younger. And I'm like, oh, really with this? When did this become a thing? This is crazy.
Yeah, doesn't seem right. The more you know, the younger you should get.
Mm.
Right? Become more valuable. You should also grow younger.
Benjamin Button, speaking of your boy, Brad Pitt.
Yeah, I've run into this a lot. Like I'm pretty good at hearing other people's voices. The reason I started to write comedy instead of just perform it was because I'd work with somebody like Brian Regan or one of these guys just have a really strong comedy voice and it would just echo in my head for a week. So I'm like, I might as well write it down and send it to him. You know?
Yeah. Isn't that funny? I started when I was traveling in Europe after my, you know, after I graduated from college, like all the, you know, all the kids do, you know, right? Like, oh, I'm going to go to Europe and get a Euro pass. And I'd be reading books, like I'd take my little paperback books or whatever, and I'd be reading them. And if I was reading Hemingway, I would write postcards home to my family in these like very sharp, like staccato sentences, you know, these very masculine, like forms of writing. And then if I was reading Dostoevsky, you know, they'd be more these florid, long sentences, convoluted, you know. And then I was like, oh, that's weird. I'm not even really trying to do that. I'm not even thinking about doing it. It's just my brain just wants to mimic whatever it is, whoever I'm reading, whoever I'm hearing. And then that was, I think, the first time that I thought, oh, that's kind of like ghostwriting. That would be really interesting. Now that was, you know, I was 21 at that point. I didn't start ghostwriting until 10 years later. But I think it always stuck in my head a little bit where I thought it's really interesting to sort of mimic a person or a place. And I think part of the reason also why I was naturally good at it is that I was a Navy brat, right? So every couple of years we'd move to a new place, new part of the country or even overseas or whatever. And so I would find myself in California, and now I'm in South Carolina, and now I'm in Florida, now I'm in Spain. And as a kid, you know, you want to, I mean, not every kid, but I think most kids, you know, you want to fit in like with people, right? So I would change my demeanor or my accent or my, how I behaved based on, oh, here's what the norms of this place are. And then I would just fit into that. And I think that was actually really superb training for becoming a ghostwriter.
Yeah, it's almost a form of linguistic acting.
Yes, totally, 100%. It's so much like, it's funny you say that because I have described it to people as like, you just become another person for a period of time. You subsume yourself in them. And it is very much like portraying a character in a movie or a television show. You just become that person. And then, and it takes me a minute after I'm done to sort of come back out of it. I'll like go flip through my scrapbooks or like read stuff I've written in the past, you know, read my own book or whatever and try to remember like, who am I as opposed to this person that I've been being for a while.
Yeah, it's linguistic play. It's a playground. And I think like you were saying, there's a certain pleasure to it. There's a certain social usefulness to it. Like growing up in Kentucky, I knew I did not fit in Kentucky. It didn't celebrate intellectualism. I could hang with the rednecks and, you know, and I was physical enough to live okay in that culture. My brain was always doing things that their brains weren't. And I recognized it pretty early on, like when I had to bridge my vocabulary with the adults, you know, when I was 7 years old, like they would be like, what word, what? Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, okay, so they don't fit mentally. And I remember the first time moving, starting grad school at UT Austin, they had a party the first week for the incoming grad students, and all the faculty and the current grad students were there, and just realized at some point, all these people speak my language. Like everybody in here can understand everything I say. That just never happened in my life.
It's pretty cool when you sort of find your people, and it takes, I mean, I think it does take a minute, you know, like you grew up in a place where you didn't feel like it really was your environment or your people. And I grew up in multiple places and thought, well, where am I? Like, I still don't really understand where I'm from, you know, like if you ask me where I'm from, really probably it would be the place where I was born. And then we moved away and moved all over the place. And then we came back and I went to high school there, and that's Pensacola, Florida. Well, Pensacola, Florida is not unlike probably where you grew up in Kentucky. It's very, very red state. It's very, very, you know, I'm a gay person. It's very not super friendly, I think, I say that, but certainly wasn't in the 80s, you know, a gay friendly place when I was growing up, you know. So it is like, it becomes this thing where it's like, well, I am not a person who's like, I'm rooted here and this is where I live and this is where I'm going to spend my life. And that's that. That's just not my life. It's not my life experience at all, you know? So there is a chameleon-like quality where it's, you know, I'm going where I'm going and I'm being who I'm being, and now I'm going to be this other person. And that's just how my life has unfolded, you know?
Well, and there's a concept in comp studies of speech accommodation. And on the light version of it, it means like if you're talking to somebody with an accent, you start to have more of an accent with them. You accommodate to their speech. on the deep level of it, it's kind of what you're talking about. You adjust down to the psychological level to fit within the social group that you're in that moment. And when you become chameleon-like, like you said, it becomes very easy to sort of get in and adapt quickly and be like, ah, I'm conversant. And it does play into the ghostwriter thing, I would assume, very nicely.
Yeah. We did. I did a book with Whitney Houston's mom, Sissy Houston. Worked with her for a few months. She's was in her 80s at that point, I think, or her late 70s. Obviously, very different life experience than what I had had. You know, an African-American woman, you know, growing up in New Jersey, living in New Jersey. She's one of the greatest backup singers in the history of music, you know. And I'm tasked with basically, you know, becoming her. And she's grieving. She's grieving the loss of her daughter. And, you know, there's all kinds of stuff, all kinds of sort of elements of all of that, you know. But it was like, you know, I got it. I got her. I understood her. Like she just, I just got her, you know? And so there was a really funny moment. Well, actually, there's two funny moments. One really funny moment when we were going through the edits of the book and it was me and the editor and this person who worked very closely with Sissy. And the editor said, I don't like this phrase. I think it's not clear. How about we change it to blah? And right away, this other person and I were like, that is not how she would say it. And he said, well, how would she say it? And I said, give me a second. And I just thought for a minute. And then I said some kind of phrase or a couple sentences or something. And the woman who had worked with Sissy for like 30 years went, I don't know how you did that, but that is exactly what she would say. So that felt really good. That felt really nice to me. And then the other moment that was just kind of funny was something that Sissy said to me at the book party, which was really nice. I mean, I probably shouldn't even tell it. And I'm just going to tell it sort of just, she said it and it meant a lot to me.
Sure.
But my name was on the cover of the book with her by Sissy Houston with me. And at the book party, she said that a few of her friends had asked whether Lisa Dickey was Black. And I was like, oh my God, like not having any idea what she was going to say. And she said, and I tell them she's Black enough. And so that was really meaningful to me. Like that was like, that felt really cool and special to me as a, just as, I mean, I'm as white as I can be, you know? And it was just a really nice moment for her to say that, which there's a whole other question about, like, I wish there were more like, you know, ghostwriters, people of color. Like, I don't know what the sort of politics are behind it all. So I just want to say all that, but I will tell you that that moment was very meaningful to me to have her express that in front of a room full of people of basically like, you know, you did the thing and you did it well. So that was really nice.
Yeah, it is. I think back when you were talking about that, I was at the Late Late Show when Craig Kilborn was there and he quit. He was the only host, I think, in the history of Hollywood who had quit a show that wanted him back for late night. And we went through about a 3-month process where we had guest hosts, new guest hosts every night. So same writing staff, but we would just bring in whoever. And they just booked across this massive range. Rosie Perez did a night, you know, like David Duchovny, like just a very wide range of people. And we would always be there to service what they wanted to do because they basically did the same show. They did a monologue and some kind of a desk sketch and whatever they wanted to do, we would help them write it. And I remember some of them came in and they just were not used to having a staff. And the staff could only adjust so much. It was mostly, it was all white guys, mostly from the East Coast, you know, Ivy Leaguers, and then me, you know, from the South. So I had a little more range on some of the things than they did. But I remember we had a comic come in. What was his name? Black comic. He's done a lot of stuff since then. I have to think about it. But really good comic, you know, but they wrote a script for him that we would have normally written. And he looked at it and we were doing rehearsal and he's like, these are not my words. Like, you've got to find new words. And he brought a couple of guys with him that knew how to adjust, you know, to his way of delivering and his language choice. And it's very specific like that, all the way down to the words that you're choosing, right, for people.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's just certain things, certain ways, I mean, that people express themselves or don't express themselves. And you know, that is my job, is to really listen and hear And it's a lot about the rhythms. It's the rhythms of speech, you know. And I do. I'm also like I love music, and I play guitar, and I sing, and I, you know, I feel like that is also very helpful, because I do think there is a certain rhythm to the way people speak that if you capture it, it sounds like them. And if you don't capture it, it doesn't sound anything like them. Like regardless of whatever the words themselves are, you know, like some people speak in really clipped sentences. Some people speak in sort of looping kind of, you know, some people always kind of reverse their, they come into it from, you know, from behind instead of being really straightforward about things. And you have to really, you have to just be such a good listener and really understand. The other thing I will say that I think was really helpful to me as a writer was learning another language, you know? So I studied Russian in college, and I spent a lot of time in Russia, and I really tried to hone my language skills, but it really made me have to think about, why do I choose the words that I choose? Why do I choose to express myself in this particular way? And it makes you really think, I think, in a way that you don't necessarily if you only speak one language. Because the ways that we express ourselves in other languages are so different, because the languages themselves are structured so differently.
Yeah, I think that hyper awareness is kind of, again, sort of the offer behind. I started this podcast basically when Trump showed up and broke politics, and people were just like, oh, you can't do anything. I'm like, that's not true. What you can do is move, like America's been very blessed in its politics for a long time. It's not violence. It's not, you know, we've had a very easy go on our politics. I had a friend from Cuba who basically, you know, got over here around the time of Bay of Pigs. He's like, y'all don't do politics. You don't understand politics. Politics is when you're worried about somebody coming to your house to pull your family out in the middle of the night. So we've had it very easy. So they show up and like you get some of these fascist techniques and some of these, you know, unethical persuasion techniques start to get some primacy, and nobody's got a sophisticated enough way of dealing with it. So I'm like, okay, let's step back and pull from something like rhetoric that understands these techniques and can do things like when you look at the word choice for a ghostwriter, like knowing that if you pick the wrong word, and if it's wrong enough, it's going to sound so sour in your client's ear.
Yeah, that's right. Yep. Yeah, it's really
that
true.
Pico level work is that's hard.
It is hard. It has to be. I think it's just like you either your ear works that way or it doesn't. You know, like I don't. It's such a fun is the wrong word, but it's just there's something so satisfying about it. There's something so satisfying about getting to the point where you understand the cadences of this other person, you know, and you're able to sort of step into them for a minute. You know, it was hard. You know, my wife, by the end of the Sissy Houston book in particular, she was like, this has been, you know, not easy, because it was a tight deadline. I was working a lot of hours, and I was putting myself in the position of a grieving person, you know, and you feel it. I mean, you feel it. You cannot talk to a person about a death that they have endured and then sit down and try to get it on the page for them without grieving yourself. It's just, if you don't grieve, you're not doing it right. You know, like you just feel it, and it's intense, you know? So I remember my wife saying, she's like, well, I'm kind of glad to have you back now. You know, that's kind of nice, you know, because I was a little bit absent for a while, which is not, you know, it's just kind of a something that happens, you know.
Well, you have to meet them at the depth of their experience, or you can't write at the depth of their experience, right?
Yeah. There has to be a degree to which, I mean, maybe other ghosts don't do it. Maybe it's the difference between like method acting and non-method acting, right? Like everybody talks about Jeremy Strong from Succession, how he's just got to suffer and he just tears it out of his guts all the time. And then Brian Cox is like, I don't know, I'm just acting, you know? So maybe there are ghosts who are just like, oh, please, whatever, you know, like enough with all of this. But I don't know, man, I feel it.
Well, you said
I'm the Jeremy Strong of ghostwriters is what I
Yeah, I am too. Like, I can't just write dispassionately about somebody's passion, you know, like I feel their emotions,
Yeah, for sure.
You also seem to have a fairly strong moral dictate for what you want to work on. Like have you ever worked on a project that you feel morally ambiguous about?
I worked on a project that I did not feel at all morally ambiguous about at the time, but then it turns out that the person that I worked with was ethically compromised and was asked to leave the organization that he had been leading, and it was super problematic. And I was like, wow, this is really interesting. This has never happened to me before. And weirdly enough, the guy came back around a couple of years later and was like, I really, really want to hire you to do another book. I need to tell my side of the story. I got framed, or I got, you know, people were screwing with me. And I was just like, I realized I did a little test for him, because he had told me a detail that was ethically questionable when we were in the editing portion of the first book. And I remember him telling me this thing and thinking, ooh, that's not a good thing that you've just told me. So as a test, when he came back around a couple of years later, I asked him, what was it that happened when blah, blah, blah happened? Because I knew the answer, and I knew it was something that he had done that was ethically questionable. And he absolutely made up an answer that made him look like a hero, and he was lying. And I was like, wow, okay. And that was the moment when I thought, this is terrible. I actually got really taken in by this person. I really believed he was doing great stuff and that he was a really cool guy. And it turns out he wasn't at all. So I feel kind of bad about that. I mean, that book came out, it didn't do well. It was a weird situation. He held onto it for way too long. And by the time it came out, he was already in trouble with his organization. And so, you know, it's not like I was spreading lies and horribleness around in the world, but it definitely gave me pause, because I think I have a pretty good sense of people and a pretty good radar. And boy, he really fooled me. But he fooled a lot of people. So.
Well, and you have to trust. You have to be vulnerable. You can't be questioning them all the time and work with them, right?
Yeah. And I still think, to this day, I think he did some good things, but I think that he just was, if not immoral, I think he was maybe amoral. I think that he wanted to make his projects succeed at all costs, and he was extremely ambitious. And I think he lost sight of the human cost of what he was doing. To this day, I don't know, if you were to ask me, like, is he a fundamentally good guy who went awry, or is he a fundamentally bad guy? I would hate to think he's actually just a fundamentally bad guy, but I don't know. I don't know. And that's a weird thing to think about somebody that I spent a lot of time with.
Yeah. And on my side of working, you know, closely with a bunch of Hollywood people and a bunch of comedy people, they're always slippery, you know, psychologically. Yeah. And morally. And mm-hmm. when I worked for Dennis Miller, I remember after I got done with that job, I was talking to somebody else about another job, and they were like, Dennis Miller, huh? And they assumed like I was somehow in line with his politics. And I'm like, well, I also wrote for Tom Arnold. Do you think, you know, I'm an idiot? You know,
yeah,
it's just a job. Yeah. Like, you know, yeah. Dennis went from the right wing or the left wing darling. Like, he was the Jon Stewart of his day when he was at HBO, and then changed sides. And you get swept up in that, like, because you are their voice and you are working for them, you know, it's easy to get with that.
Yeah. And also it's hard because people change, right? So, like, you know, for all those of us in the gay community, Ellen DeGeneres was a superhero for years and years, you know, and then she became the kind of person who was like, wow, these choices you're making are extremely poor choices, you know? And it's just, you know, it just becomes like, oh, well, that happened. And, you know, I don't know. People change. Things happen.
Yeah, I think that sort of moral anchor for who you'll work with. And, you know, you want projects that are going to, like you said, they're going to make you money. They're going to make you happy to work with this person. They're going to feel morally correct. Yeah. So you want all those things to line up. Yeah. For my world, they rarely do. Like, there's always a couple of chunks in the armor, you're like, I'll have to deal with that. But
I had one job where somebody pitched me. It was a guy who had previously been like a security person for super high level pop stars, you know, like, so he'd seen everything. He'd seen overdoses, he'd seen, like, you know, I don't know, just every possible crap thing you can imagine that happens in people's lives. And he was pitching this book, was like the inside story of being a Hollywood security guy. And I was like, first of all, as a person who is a ghostwriter and a person to whom people divulge things and reveal things, I would never, never, never turn around and reveal and divulge things for my own book to make some money. Like, that's crazy. And it wasn't even like, the book didn't even have some sort of redeeming, like, the reason I'm telling you this is because, I don't know, like, don't do drugs, kids, or whatever, right. You know? It was literally just, he had this information, he thought it was titillating, he thought enough people would be interested in it that he could sell some books and make a buck. And I was actually much more pissed off at the agent who brought it to me than I was at the guy, because I figured, whatever, this guy is, I don't know him. But this agent I had worked with on a couple other things, and, you know, she was like, I actually wrote her a letter where I said, I'm so disappointed you're bringing this to me, and I'm so disappointed you're actually repping this guy. I'm really shocked by that. And I don't even know what to say. And I'm sure that this is going to sting hearing this from me, but I don't feel right not saying it to you. I don't think this book should even exist.
Nice one. Good, strong.
So that happened. Yeah.
Well, and I think you've got to be involved
in. She wrote back something about, like, oh, you know, if there's some things of interest here or whatever, there can be some good that can come of it or whatever. And, you know, I'm sorry if you don't, whatever. And that was it. I never heard from her again, and she never heard from me again. So that was that.
It's such an odd space when you do public messaging that has the potential to affect people, you know, and the moral universe that comes lumbering over to get dropped on top of you in comedy.
Right.
You know, it's so weird now when you look at this theoretically, comedy is supposed to be its own sphere. It doesn't run by the same rules as the rest of the world. It doesn't have the same moral structures as the rest of the world. And if you import those over into comedy, you know, like the Chappelle thing, any of the shock comics, any of the social issue comics, they're going to stomp on minds no matter what. That's what they do.
Yeah.
But if you start making moral judgments about them versus comedy judgments, everything just gets crazy so fast.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tricky.
I think even Ellen, you know, I worked with Ellen when she was just a comic before she even got into TV. And she was one of the top five most talented stand-up comedians I've ever seen. She was just
She's insanely talented, and she's incredibly brave. And what she did, you know, coming out in the way that she did and the way that she handled herself and the, like, she saved a lot of lives. I mean, no joke. She really changed the trajectory for gay people in this country, 100%. But then, you know, to have just lost the thread in the way that she did all these years later is just like, it's saddening, honestly, I think.
And I think it is that weird, you know, again, nobody can relate to that experience of becoming world famous, multi-millionaire, you know, and know what it does to you psychologically. You know, it's not, you're not in the same conditions and as you were, like, when she was just a not out comic, and then when she was an out comic TV personality, and then when she's this super, like, I can't imagine psychologically what that does to people.
I can't either, but don't you think that in some ways it just amplifies or magnifies whoever it is that you really are at your core? You know, like, I mean, I don't know, like, I don't, the kinds of things that happen were just sort of like, I don't know. I mean, I've never been famous, so what do I know? But I would like to think that if I ever became globally famous, I would sort of remain the uptight, you know, morality person that I think that I am. You know?
I don't know. Everybody I know from my world that has flamed up or flared up into the public eye for real has weirded out. They've all gone somewhere.
I don't know.
So, well, this has been super fun. I don't want to keep you. I usually do this about an hour. But you've got this deep experience. Like I said, it really interests me when people have come from this world of, you know, sort of they're feeling their way through a medium and language and writing and looking around the world. Where can I apply this? Both for moral things and professional things. And you've clearly found a nice slice.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really glad I kind of fell into this work, you know. It was just but it turned out it's a very weird set of skills you need to have to do it, and I had just happen to have those skills, and so it's very lucky I feel like that I fell into it, because it just was a good it was a good fit for me. So
Are you doing
yeah,
something now you want to? I don't know. I don't guess you need to promote it. They promote it.
I know, right? I can't really, like, the next book I'm doing, I think pretty sure my name's gonna be on the cover with the person, but it'll come out in 2023, and then I'll put it up on my website. Y'all can look at my website and see everybody I've worked with. Everybody except for one. There's one person I'm not allowed to put up. She's the most
Ah.
famous one of all, probably, but anyway.
Yeah, I've run into that too. Like some comics don't want to be people to know that they didn't write those jokes. I've literally been standing next to a comic that I've known forever and I've written for, and somebody will come and go, "Oh man, that bit about that was great." And he's just like, thanks. And then other comics are like, "Well, talk to the guy who wrote it. You know,
You're
he's
not
right
even
here." So you never know what, psychologically what
so
they need
irritating.
to,
Yeah. But
Well,
you
cool.
know, it's for whatever headaches there are, it's totally worth it for me. I just love it. I love what I do.
Well, you obviously do it very well. Very interesting conversation. I appreciate you jumping on.
It was fun. Thanks,
Yeah.
Dr. Dan.
Dr. Dan, talking
All
about the
right.
words.
Appreciate it.
All right. Well, this has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Read something by Lisa Dickey. Do you get
Yeah.
royalties?
Yeah, sometimes depends. But here's what you should really read. This is my book, Bears in the Streets:
Bears in the Streets.
Three Journeys Across a Changing Russia by me. This is
About
the only
Lisa.
one that's actually mine. It's just propping up my computer, but hold on, I'll show you a picture of me in 1995. This is when I did three trips across Russia in 1995, and then again in 2005, and then again in
Awesome.
2015. And I interviewed the same people every time. 20 years of interviews. It's like the 7-Up thing. It's like
Yeah, I was
interviewing
thinking
the same
since you
people
said
over
that,
time.
like that's
Yeah.
a cool
Yeah, so
idea.
it's kind of fun. Check it out.
Check it out, Bears in the
Boost
Street.
my if 10 of you buy it, you'll double my sales. It'll be great.
All right, well, that's going to be our goal with this episode is to
Perfect.
double her sales on this.
That's right. Do it.
All right, well, thanks, Lisa. Appreciate it
All
very
right,
much.
Dan. I appreciate it. That's fun.
Yep. This has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. As always, get out there and persuade some people. They need it. You can do it. Go do it.
Go do it.